used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at axissacramento.org, or you can hear this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Facing Disaster in the Middle East with Stephen Kinzer. American and European policies in the Middle East have produced a region immersed in violence, terror, anger, and oppression. The West needs to change policies that were shaped for the Cold War. Kinzer offers ideas for a better approach to the world's most turbulent region. And then after that, toxic lead still in brass plumbing. Officials at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill tested water coming from new brass plumbing in some of the college's new buildings and found it contains high levels of lead.
If Iran sees it as being in Iran's interest, if Iran is assured by diplomacy that the U.S. is not going to use a stable Iraq as a platform to attack Iran, then Iran could contribute decisively to a resolution of this very daunting problem. In addition, Iran has tremendous ability to influence the course of events in Afghanistan. As many of you know, the entire western region of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran up until Iran lost a war in the 18th century. The language they speak there is the exact same language that is spoken in Iran. In addition, Iran has a host of common interests with the U.S. For example, Iran wants to keep Russian influence out of the Middle East. That's a stated objective of American policy. The Iranian oil industry is in a state of total collapse. It needs billions, tens of billions of dollars of investment. American companies are best positioned in the world to do that large infrastructure work. There's even a role for Halliburton here. We're very good. Since we destroy so much in the world, we've really built up a lot of infrastructure companies that know how to rebuild it. Actually, there's no major American strategic goal in the Middle East that can be reached without Iran's cooperation. Whether it is a resolution to the Israel-Palestine problem, whether it's the stabilization and democratization of Iraq, whether it's a nuclear-free Middle East, reduction of sectarian tension in Lebanon, evolution in Syria, Iran can have a huge influence in this. Now, why don't we recognize this? What is the problem that prevents us from embracing this new paradigm? Well, I think, first of all, there's a larger problem, which is the one I started out with, which is that we have our policies set. It's very difficult, particularly given the pathologies of American domestic politics, for us to change our policies. But in particular, we have a special problem with Iran. This is the most dysfunctional relationship in the whole world. There are no two countries in the world that have been at each other's throats so intensely for so long as the United States and Iran. Each country harbors a deep sense of grievance about the other, feels terribly wounded by the other. Neither country has made much of an effort to see the world as it would look from the other side. From America's point of view, we feel wronged by Iran starting from the hostage crisis. This is something that, even though it's 30 years ago, and in fact the anniversary is coming up, I believe, next week, the 30th anniversary at the end of that ordeal, we feel that they hit us and they hurt us in a terrible way, and we've never really been able to hit them back. In addition, they have been subverting our policies, sometimes very violently, all over the world. So we feel that before we will sit down with them, we need to punish them, we need to hurt them somehow. This is an example of emotion taking over foreign policy making. And emotion is always the number one enemy of sound diplomacy. If we would leave our emotions outside the room, we would be able to recognize the commonalities of our interests. Now, if we could do that, what steps should we take? It's unclear. Nobody can say whether a new American approach to the current regime in Iran would produce a breakthrough. If it were so easy, it probably would have been done already. Nonetheless, we're not really making an effort. We are not trying to break the deadlock with Iran. Our approach, the American approach to Iran now, is that Iran must negotiate with us on one issue. That's the issue we care about, the nuclear issue. We insist that they reach a resolution to this issue that is satisfactory to us, which they would call surrender. This is unlikely to happen. If you put yourself in their shoes, it doesn't make sense for them to surrender the highest card in their diplomatic hand in exchange for nothing other than a promise that maybe later on we'd be willing to talk about other things. Instead, we should take an approach similar to the approach that we took with China in the 1970s. The first document that came out of that process, which I've now gone back to read more intensely as I've been focusing more on Iran, was the Shanghai Communique of 1974. It's a very interesting document. It's very short, and it contains no agreements. That came later. It has three parts. The first part is written by the American side, everything we don't like about China and what China does in the world. Second part, written by China, everything we don't like about U.S. policy. And the third part is an agreement by both sides to negotiate on these issues and not to try to resolve them by force. In other words, it's an agenda. That would be the way to break the ice with Iran. Let's start by opening the agenda and saying, we don't insist that you negotiate only on the one issue we care about. We will negotiate on issues that you care about. What are they? In that way, we can look towards the creation of some kind of global agreement, the beginnings of a new security architecture for that region, in which Iran, receiving something, would be willing to make concessions. The world needs a big security concession from Iran. The world also needs big security concessions from Israel. But countries only make security concessions when they feel safe. Therefore, it should be in the interest of outside powers whose long-term interest in the Middle East is stability, to do whatever possible to help stabilize that region and make countries there feel safe enough to make concessions. Now, Turkey has a piece of advice for us on how to do this. What Turkey is saying to the U.S. is, we're on your side. We want to help you. But we have some advice for you about Iran. You're handling it the wrong way. You need to be less confrontational. You need to see if you can work out compromise. This is a word that we're still not used to using in our diplomatic discourse. India recently has begun making the same case to the U.S. India, of course, they're not actual neighbors of Iran now, but that's just the last 50 years. Iran and India were neighbors for thousands of years. So both Turkey and India are making this case to the U.S. Change your policy toward Iran. It would be good for everybody, including you. We are not listening to that advice now. I believe that simply making an offer of unconditional negotiations would set off a whole series of debates inside the Iranian regime. That alone would be, I think, a very positive step. And I think it holds out the possibility for a breakthrough. But what's most important for us, whether or not it's possible to reach an accord with this regime, is that we do nothing toward Iran which will make it impossible for us to reach an accord when circumstances change. And they will change. Say that although I like the Shanghai communique and the model for the beginnings of a new relationship with Iran, I also think a very important component of any American negotiating effort with Iran would have to be the human rights component. It would not be possible for us to make an agreement with simply the Iranian regime on the backs of those very brave people that went out onto the streets in ways that I don't know how many of us would do to protest the electoral outcome last year. That's why I like the Helsinki model. The Helsinki Accords gave both camps something that they needed, and they also included a human rights component. I think this is very important for the United States. We've gotten ourselves into terrible trouble in the Middle East by forging relationships that are just between ruling elites, between governments, between ruling classes. We've done this in other parts of the world as well. This is very damaging because those elites tend to be unpopular with their own countries, and then the U.S. begins to share the unpopularity, and we become the targets of people in those countries who actually support what we like to think of as Western interests. I guess if there ever is a time when the U.S. and Iran finally sit down for a negotiating session that's serious, the T-shirts I'd like to print up and hand out would say something like, from Shanghai to Helsinki. That would be the motto I'd like to see as we begin on a new process. I often thought to myself while I was writing this book, what would be a nice quote to encapsulate this approach that you could put on the back of the T-shirts? I'm a great Shakespeare lover, and so I came up with this line from Hamlet, which I do think encapsulates my views about the U.S. and how it needs to change its approach to the Middle East, although that may not be what Shakespeare had in mind when he wrote it. I do not know why yet I live to say this thing's to do, since I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. So I thought that was a pretty clever quote, but after a while I began to realize that it was culturally inappropriate, because Shakespeare is not part of the cultural heritage of that region, so I was looking for another one that I thought would be better, and I found one from Rumi, who was actually the perfect person to take it from, since he was Persian, he wrote in Persian, but yet he's buried in what's now Turkey, and both countries claim him. And he wrote something even simpler and more concise that I think would be my central question, my central appeal to the foreign policymakers in Washington and other Western capitals. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Thank you.
Stephen, would you like to sit down?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to open the floor to questions. I'd like you to keep the questions brief, please, because we have a lot of you in the audience, and I want to have everyone to have the opportunity to ask a question. So, who's going to start? Yes. It may be an idea to identify yourself as well, please.
Thank you for a very interesting lecture. I'm Janos Jerman, student here at LSE. I was wondering, you said Turkey and Iran are two potential candidates for kind of a rather long-term partnership. What do you think, which role could Turkey play in the in the long-term process towards Iran? You mentioned that they are already active in the nuclear negotiations. Whether or not that's really successful, we don't really know. I don't really know. But still, Turkey wants to play this long-term strategic partner between the West and the Middle East in general. Thank you.
I was in Istanbul last spring when we woke up in the morning to the news that the Prime Minister of Turkey and the President of Brazil had succeeded in reaching some kind of an accord with Iranian leaders on the nuclear issue. We were thrilled. Everybody in Istanbul was thrilled that not only did it seem like this crisis was finally beginning to calm down, but Turkey had played a role in helping to make this happen. So that was great. And that euphoria lasted about 6 hours until people started waking up in Washington. And not only did Washington reject that deal, but American leaders actually condemned Turkey for having had the temerity to go out and try to negotiate with Iran. Essentially, it was a very American attitude, which is, you idiots, you were taken advantage of by those very crafty Iranians, but you're not smart enough to realize that they were using you. This is sort of a traditional American approach, but it really doesn't go down well in much of the rest of the world. Now, the American complaint was that that deal was incomplete, that there were a lot of holes in it, and that was true. But if we were seriously interested in making progress with Iran, we could have grabbed onto it, and we could have said just that. There are a lot of holes in this agreement, but this is better than we've had so far, so let's build on it. Here are our problems with it. These are the issues we want to pursue. But we didn't do that. We rejected it out of hand. Now, I think that Turkey still can play a role as a mediator between the United States and Iran, but in order for that to happen, the United States has to want that to happen, and so far we're not looking for a mediator. India is another possibility for this. But I also look forward to this. So Turkey is booming. Turkey is expanding. Turkey is growing economically at a spectacular rate, and its political influence is growing even faster. The mantra of Turkish leaders now is this. It comes out in every speech that Tayyip Erdogan makes. We must get to be one of the 10 biggest economies in the world. They are now number 16. And they will, according to what economists say, make it in some decades. They are going to get there. But everything they're doing is based on this. They know that without a stable neighborhood, they're not going to make it. Turkey is the number one contributor to the economy of Iraq, for example. 80% of the foreign companies working in Iraq are Turkish. That's true in much of the Middle East. But if the Middle East explodes again or remains full of tension, that's not good for Turkey. Turkey knows this. And therefore, I would foresee that if Turkey and the United States cannot get a little closer on this issue, and Turkey continues to be unsuccessful in persuading the United States to modify its approach to Iran, I could see a Turkey-Iran partnership of a sort emerging. That's a $1.5 trillion economy. That's a huge piece of geography. Does the United States want to let this happen without being part of it? India could even be a part of this. When we think about new blocs forming in the future, the United States should not assume that any bloc we're not a part of is automatically going to fail or be unsuccessful. So Turkey's a country that, if we start to change our minds and decide we want to listen to other countries, would be a great first choice.
My name is Richard Tepeth. I'm retired and I'm enjoying travelling. And about 5 years ago, I was in Iran where I would endorse or echo the sort of things you said. Someone came up to me and said, life was much better under the Shah, out of the blue. A year ago, I was in Gaza with Viva Palestina. You haven't mentioned much about Israel. There is a perception that US support for Israel is absolute. Including substantial financial backing. You haven't mentioned much about that. Would you care to comment?
I thought I could get away with just saying there are pathologies in American politics that make it difficult for us to change our approach. But I'll talk a little more about that. It is true that this is something that separates the U.S. from all of its allies, including Britain, the tremendous pull, political and emotional, that Israel has on the body politic. I don't expect that to change dramatically, but let me make two observations. First of all, the Iranians have never come to me and asked for advice, but if they did, I would tell them this. You're not going to have any success in trying to get the U.S. to change its policy toward you. You can't do that. And even our friends like Turkey and India can't get us to do that. But your long-term relationship with Israel over the long-term last 60 years, not to mention your thousands of years of relationship between Persians and Jews, makes it quite possible and conceivable for you to approach Israel in a quiet way and see in ways that Arab countries could not do if it wouldn't be possible to have to try to calm that relationship. If that relationship could somehow be calmed, then I think Israel might be the one country whose advice we would listen to. And that might be a way. I think that option is still out there because of the history of these relationships. If you've been to Iran, you know that Iranians actually have a tremendous admiration for Jews. I've heard this many times. They're people like us. They're an ancient civilization. They value culture and they're educated. I don't want to contrast them to anyone else in that neighborhood of the world, but there is a sense of kinship. Here's the other thing that I would say. I believe it is and will always remain a goal of the United States to protect and defend Israel over the long run, and I think this is right. However, Israeli politicians, like politicians in every country, are the product of their own political environment. They have to respond to the clamor of their own electorate. What I think this has done for Israel is to push it in a very self-defeating direction. Israel is repeatedly taking steps in the Middle East, including in Gaza, that undermine the regional stability that is actually Israel's only long-term guarantee of security. Israel is not going to be able to defend itself indefinitely by military means alone. If you look at the geography, then you factor in the demography of that region, you realize that that Israel alone in a sea of nations that hate it is very insecure. So I look at the U.S.-Israel relationship a bit like I look at the relationship between me and my friend who wants to drive drunk. He's my friend, but I feel that he's using poor judgment. I want to try to help him steer the car a little more effectively. And in the long run, I think that the only thing that would make a dramatic change in this relationship would be if the United States were preferably in conjunction with other countries, and this is where I really think Europe could play a role, to say to Israel, you have a limited time period in which to make some dramatic changes. Otherwise, we're going to do one of two things. Either we're going to recognize Palestine as a state in the borders outside 1967 borders of Israel, or we are going to recognize Israel as sovereign over that entire region, in which case everybody's going to have a vote and the Jews will automatically become a minority in their own country. Unless you give an ultimatum that allows Israeli leaders and perhaps also Palestinian leaders the chance to say, I hate this, but we have to do it because the world is making us do it, I don't see a way that this current relationship is going to produce any breakthrough.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.